The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Eade, Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Friday, May 31st, 2024, and we have one case on our calendar for oral argument today. As noted, I'm Judge Sarah Wheelock, presiding on a panel with Judge Jill Halbrooks and Judge Keala Eade. And this morning, we are holding our arguments via Zoom.gov, and I'll address a few matters in our virtual format. So our oral arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio is generally available within about 24 hours on the branch's website. In addition, the rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument unless they've received the approval of the court within about 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific additional rules. So with that, Marshall, please call the first and the only case on our calendar this morning.
Now calling case number A231249. State of Minnesota v. Azelle Mickey Lee Foster.
And counsel, as you both know, I think, as you've been here before, there are 15 minutes for each of you for your principal argument with an additional 5 minutes for the attorney for the appellant for rebuttal. There should be a clock in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. I see both attorneys nodding, so they should be able to see that, and that will reset according to the time you have available for your argument. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument so that the recording is clear, and pronounce your name and your client's name so we know that we have that correct and any other information that's important for how we might refer to your client. In addition, please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not presenting. And finally, if anyone has any technical or technological difficulties during the argument at any point, please let me know. We will pause the proceedings and we will address that because we want to be sure that we can hear from everyone this morning. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Azelle Mickey Lee Foster. I raised three issues in the brief, and today I'd like to focus on the trial court's failure to appoint substitute counsel, despite exceptional circumstances that impacted Mr. Foster's attorney's ability and competence to represent him. Minnesota Statute 634.35 requires attorneys to sign an acknowledgement that they are aware of the statute before receiving discovery of interviews and related materials involving child victims. Mr. Foster's attorney, Brian Leary, did not want to sign the form. Over the course of nearly 9 months, as trial approached, Mr. Leary obstinately refused to sign the form. Mr. Foster's trial began without Mr. Leary and Mr. Foster seeing the most critical evidence against him because of Mr. Leary's actions. This is the exceptional and unprecedented circumstance that warranted the court stepping in and substituting counsel. The trial court in this case made two critical errors that resulted in Mr. Foster going to trial with an attorney who could not adequately represent him. First, the court failed to correct Mr. Leary's misstatement of law that suggested Mr. Foster was not entitled to substitute counsel under any circumstances. Second, the court failed to appoint substitute counsel, despite the fact that there were exceptional circumstances that impacted Mr. Leary's ability to represent Mr. Foster. Addressing the first error, case law makes clear it is error to suggest the court does not have the power to appoint substitute counsel. Mr. Leary informed the court that Mr. Foster wanted a different attorney about 3 months before trial. Mr. Foster personally addressed the court and told the court that he believed Mr. Leary was providing ineffective assistance. Mr. Leary and his supervisor had told Mr. Foster that he could not have a new public defender, that if he fired Mr. Leary, he fired the office. And the court did not correct this misstatement. It did not tell Mr. Foster that it could appoint substitute counsel if there were exceptional circumstances. This court in Lamar made clear that it is error to misinform the defendant that he cannot have a new public defender under any circumstances.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? I was wondering if there's evidence in the record that the disagreement that Mr. Foster raised in the hearing before Judge Meyer was related to the decision not to sign, trial counsel's decision not to sign the 634-35 acknowledgement, or if it was explained more explicitly what the basis for that disagreement is.
No, Your Honor, he did not elaborate on that request. He told the court that he believed he was receiving ineffective assistance of counsel. The only issue throughout the proceedings, though, that would give rise to that really is the refusal to sign the form.
I asked because of the case law indicating that a general disagreement with trial counsel isn't enough to constitute an exceptional circumstance. So I'm wondering if it matters for purposes of your argument that there isn't evidence of what the exact disagreement was at that point in time.
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is. First of all, there is information in the trial record prior to that. And I think, but your question really relates to what Judge Meyer knew at that hearing. Am I understanding that correct? Mr. Foster explained that he was receiving ineffective assistance of counsel. So that is the serious allegation of inadequate representation that would trigger the searching inquiry. So all of the cases that the state cites in the footnote regarding when a searching inquiry is required, in all of those cases, the defendants merely noted that they were unhappy with their attorney, or they believed that the attorney, they had a disagreement about strategy or which witnesses to call. None of those defendants alleged ineffective assistance of counsel. So in this case, Judge Meyer had an obligation to ask a question. I mean, Judge Meyer could have asked a simple question. Why do you believe that? Instead of just dismissing his concerns out of hand. But Mr. Foster did enough, and he did more than, as much or more than the defendants in Gillum and in Clark. And in those cases, there was a searching inquiry.
Ms. Martin, didn't the court, though, made some statement about, you come at this from a different perspective than your attorney. You've lived the experience. Your attorney has the legal background. The way I read that portion of the transcript, if I'm recalling it correctly, you can tell me if I'm not, it did seem to be more of a statement of strategy disagreement. And at that point, Mr. Foster didn't contradict the court or say anything additional.
At that point, Mr. Foster had been told by two attorneys that there's no right to substitute counsel. So it is unreasonable to expect him to elaborate, to ask for something he's already been told by two people with law degrees that he can't have. This court in Walford, in the order opinion I sent in the supplemental authority, made that point clear as well, that it's not reasonable to expect a defendant who is not trained in the law to ask for something he has already been told he can't have. Especially where the court didn't correct that statement. And again, he didn't just say, I have a disagreement about trial strategy. He made clear that he thought that his attorney was ineffective. The second error in this case is the failure to appoint substitute counsel. The law is clear that the district court must appoint substitute counsel if exceptional circumstances exist, the demand is timely and reasonably made. And exceptional circumstances are those that directly impact the attorney's ability and competence to represent the defendant. The circumstances in this case were truly exceptional. There is no case cited in either brief that deals with a situation like this, where appointed counsel is acting in a manner directly adverse to his client's interests. Mr. Leary admitted that this was not trial strategy. He was not taking this stand on his client's behalf. He expressly disclaimed that it was trial strategy. This was Mr. Leary's personal quest. He disagreed with the law and he was going to take a stand, even though it conflicted with Mr. Foster's interests.
Where is the evidence in the record that the case was not tried competently?
The evidence in the record as to prejudice, Your Honor, is Mr. Leary made a record throughout the trial about how he was impacted by this. He could not perform discovery or investigation as he would have if he had had all of the information available. He could not properly advise his client before trial about the strength of the state's case and whether to take a plea offer. He couldn't prepare. He couldn't investigate. He couldn't effectively cross-examine witnesses. He made, after they came back from the weekend break, he made a lengthy record about how his preparation over the weekend had been impacted, because if he had had these materials over the weekend, he would have prepared for cross-examination. He couldn't effectively cross-examine the state's witnesses, the expert witnesses, because he didn't have the information ahead of time. He didn't have the ability to show.
Could you just be a little more specific? What information did he not have? You're talking with this cross-examination preparation.
He did not have the Corner House tapes, and he didn't have the reports from Corner House.
But by that point, he had the judge had permitted access to them. Is that right?
The judge had permitted access, but only access for a limited period of time, and only in the presence of someone from the county attorney's office. He can't effectively prepare with his client as he's sitting there with a member of the county attorney's office. There is no attorney.
Well, I'm not saying he should use that time to prepare, but he could certainly review the material without hindrance under those circumstances.
He could have reviewed the material. That's correct. But he was limited in the amount of time he could have reviewed the material. The state had this material for months and months and months before trial, and had undoubtedly reviewed it multiple times. And I would think that most trial attorneys, if they had had the information, most defense attorneys would have reviewed it multiple times, 10, 20 times, looking for all of the information in there. The other thing that the video provides is information for on how credibly the witnesses are going to present, how they answer questions. That would impact ability to prepare for trial and to advise his client before trial.
But what do you make of your counterpart's argument in the brief, the respondent's brief, that Mr. Leary boasted that he already knew the detailed contents of the Corner House evidence based on the sergeant's report? He made that claim that it didn't really matter what was in it. And then I think to Judge Holbrook's point, the question is what specific prejudice actually resulted from the fact that he was preparing on the eve of trial due to the 634-35 decision.
Yes, he did make a statement that he knew some of the substance of the Corner House materials. However, an officer's summary is not the same as actually viewing the information. It's obviously not as thorough as the officer's report does not contain every single thing that the witnesses stated during the Corner House video. It doesn't do anything to show their how they are responding to questions, how credible they come across. And those are all things that impact pretrial investigation and pretrial advising the client. I would also like to point out that no Minnesota appellate case addresses whether to apply the harmless error standard, because no case has ever found error for failing to appoint substitute counsel. So it's unclear if we even get to the a prejudice prong. In Gonzalez-Lopez, the U.S. Supreme Court explained why deprivation of counsel of choice is a structural error. And the reasoning it applied in that case is really equally applicable to failing to appoint substitute counsel.
Can I ask you, one more?
Sorry, Judge. Just ask one quick follow-up on that. I mean, you acknowledge we have no authority to apply that test in this instance, in terms of Minnesota authority.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. There have been Minnesota cases that have found the error in misadvising the defendant about the ability to appoint substitute counsel. That's harmless. But in those cases, there was no harm because there were no exceptional circumstances. In this case, there were exceptional circumstances. Mr. Leary did not have the most critical discovery before trial.
I just wanted to ask before your time runs out a quick question about your Spriegel argument. So my question relates to the way that the evidence was introduced at trial. And what I'm wondering is, what do we make of, you know, assuming we disagree with you that Judge Allen didn't err in admitting the Spriegel evidence to begin with, how do we interpret the fact that if we were to reverse and remand on the ground that the evidence wasn't introduced with sufficient similarity to the charged acts, at a retrial, it would be likely much more prejudicial to have that additional information, prejudicial to your client's case. If that additional information were introduced. And so how do we interpret whether that would be harmless error? I mean, I guess what I'm driving at is it seems more likely that the conviction would be returned again if that additional information were introduced.
Well, the question in this case, I think it is whether the court first erred and whether the error was prejudicial. And it's not necessarily to think about what might happen on retrial. The information in this case, it was not introduced with sufficient specificity. And therefore, it's more likely there's a lot of case law that suggests that if it is not sufficiently similar, it's more likely to be used by the jury for an improper purpose. On retrial, I guess it could be relitigated, whether it should actually even come in at all.
That's my question, though, just for assuming we disagree on that point and we affirm Judge Allen's decision to admit it in the first instance. My question is, you know, for the prejudice aspect of it, it would seem to me that it's difficult to argue that your client was prejudiced by the admission without the additional details when the additional details likely would have supported the conviction further. And I'm wondering why I'm wrong about that or if I'm thinking about it the wrong way.
Well, I think that if the state's witness can't provide those additional details, then the evidence wouldn't come in at all.
Thank you. Okay, and your time is up. And so we will turn to attorney for respondent. There are 15 minutes on the clock. And if you unmute yourself, then please recall to introduce yourself at the beginning of your presentation. You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. While counsel was arguing this morning, I did look back at the transcript regarding issue one, the hearing in November of 2022, what exactly appellant did say to Judge Meyer, and what the court has asked in terms of questions so far does reflect what happened at that hearing. That under the context, appellant simply said, I don't think he's effective. We had a disagreement on things and I don't want to proceed with him. And I'm sure this court has seen many appeals where appellants do provide some sort of vague complaint about ineffectiveness, meaning my attorney won't call me back as often as I'd like. They don't visit me as often as I'd like. And we have a disagreement on things. So I think that's the important context of the November 2022 hearing in front of Judge Meyer, which is consistent with the questioning I've heard from the court so far. The second point I'd like to make regards Judge Eade's questions and other judges' questions about the letter of supplemental authority filed by counsel for appellant in this case. And I don't see counsel for appellant. Should I pause? Oh, sorry. sorry about that, Ms. Martin. First of all, the case is cited in appellant's counsel's letter of supplemental authority. Counsel does cite an order opinion I've never seen an order opinion cited as supplemental authority. And I think under the rules, such an order opinion can't constitute a supplemental authority within the meaning of the rules, because under the rules, that type of opinion is only to be used as to the case where the order opinion was actually issued in. So I don't think this court can consider the order opinion. And regarding the federal case that was cited, that was a United States Supreme Court case with a majority opinion and a dissent. And in that case, it's factually distinguishable from this case, because the federal case has to do with a right to choice of private counsel that was already obtained and paid for and had been discussing the case. And in that case, the district court trying the case precluded that chosen private defense counsel from participating in the case. So that was a deprivation of counsel of choice that was already obtained. It was not a case that had to do with appointed counsel. And in fact, in Scalia's opinion and in the dissent, they both discuss how the right to counsel of choice does not extend to defendants who require counsel to be appointed for them. The pin site is at the U.S. Reporter 151. And then the court continued to go on that that is a lawful outcome because there are other safeguards with regard to effective appointed counsel that the states have all recognized, including the state of Minnesota.
It seems like a fair amount of your argument relies on our agreement with the idea that this wasn't an exceptional circumstance. Mm-hmm. You distinguish a number of cases in your brief on that ground. But why shouldn't we consider the fact? I mean, we have trial counsel here repeatedly stating that this isn't trial strategy. It doesn't appear to be based on trial strategy, but rather just a disagreement with the district court's view on the applicability of the statute to this particular case and these facts. So why shouldn't we consider this to be exceptional circumstances?
Sure. The exceptional circumstances as listed in case law in Minnesota must regard the counsel's competence and ability to represent the client in a particular case. So the only claim of lack of competence had to do with the corner house discovery. And all of those concerns were painstakingly assuaged by Judge Allen ultimately. So if we're talking about what happened in November of 2022, that's when appellant did request substitute appointed counsel in front of Judge Meyer. Judge Meyer's comments back to appellant, they were discussing this just between the two of them, essentially to have Judge Meyer sort of get a grip on what is the basis of appellant's position about the disagreement on things and wanting a new public defender. And I think there that Judge Meyer's comments indicate exactly how unexceptional appellant's explanation of wanting a new public defender really was. This is not the first time Judge Meyer has been presented with a defendant who wanted a different public defender. I think this happens quite frequently. Members of this panel have had district court experience, and I'm sure they've been faced with a similar
go ahead, Judge. No,
sorry. But in this case, we don't just have comments on the record by the appellant. We also have statements on the record by the attorney explicitly saying, I didn't do this part of the preparation, and here's why. Mm-hmm. So it seems that there may be a reason to look at this case differently. What are your thoughts on that?
Your Honor, there is no reason to look at this case differently. You're looking at what happened when the request came in November of 2022. The record made is so sparse. There was really nothing that Judge Meyer could sort of hang her hat on to discuss this further. And that's not to say that Judge Meyer necessarily was not aware of the record or the protective orders filed by Judge Allen previous to November 2022. I mean, district courts have their own sort of record system where notes can be taken. And So all that is to say, if you're looking at whether Judge Meyer abused her discretion at the November 2022 hearing, there simply isn't anything in that record to hang appellant's hat on, essentially, to get a new public defender under these circumstances. Those aren't exceptional circumstances. There wasn't enough even for Judge Meyer to dig into. That's not to say that appellant was precluded from continuing the conversation and saying, this is why he's ineffective. This is why we have a disagreement on things. But that is what Judge Meyer was working with under the circumstances. So that can't be
reasonable for us to expect him, to your opposing counsel's point. Was it reasonable to expect that after Mr. Foster had been told twice that, in fact, there was no option to get substitute counsel?
There are two reasons why it wouldn't be reasonable to us to believe that appellant was precluded from continuing this conversation. The first one is evidenced in the record on November 28th of 2022. Appellant says, I don't believe the public defender's office when they say I can never have another public defender. So that is certainly something that he did not believe to be true. And then the second reason that's not reasonable is this is not appellant's first go around in a criminal court. He has been represented by counsel before. He was represented when he pleaded guilty in Otter Tail to anal and vaginal penetration of a 5 to 6 year old cousin of his. And so for two reasons, that is simply not reasonable. This is an appellant who does not have an issue advocating for himself in the courtroom setting. He did so in November of 2022, and he also did so in March of 2023. So that's not reasonable in this case. But back to the letter of supplemental authority, there's just one point I want to make. In that case, the Supreme Court essentially held for the first time that it is structural error for an appellant or a defendant to be denied his counsel, his private counsel of choice under those circumstances, and that a district court who performs that error, that it does result in structural error, but that is not the case in Minnesota. There still must be harm, and that is established since the 1970s. Fagerstrom was the first case that is cited by the parties in the 1970s that requires an appellant to demonstrate some harm here, and has been sort of questioned and answered so far in appellant's argument this morning. There is no prejudice. and at this point, I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court may have.
I have a question. Oh, go ahead, Judge Wheelock.
Go ahead, Judge Eid. You may go first.
So I had a question for you similarly regarding the evidentiary issues and specifically as to the Spriegel issue. My concern is that I'm interested in your response to Ms. Martin's argument about the way that the Spriegel evidence was introduced at trial, and why we shouldn't consider the lack of sufficient similarity in the testimony that came out to be reversible error.
Sure, I have a few responses to that. But is Your Honor specifically asking me to talk about, you know, time, place, MO, and how that isn't enough, or just the way that the evidence came in and the spectrum that Spriegel can present itself? What do I make of that?
Right. Not the initial decision by Judge Allen to admit the evidence, but lack of similarity as it was actually introduced at trial.
What I will say is that what I heard from Judge Eid, your question to opposing counsel this morning, is similar to what Judge Allen wrote in her initial Spriegel order and what she stated on the record at the time of the motion to strike. And that is, you know, Spriegel evidence is sort of on a spectrum, how markedly similar it must be. And then also on that spectrum, the more similar, the more prejudicial is what I hear Judge Allen wrote in her order and stated at the hearing, and what I hear from questioning this morning. And I think that is true. I think I did point that out in my brief, that if it's essentially a copy and paste of a crime that happened with appellant's young prepubescent female cousin and what happened now, I think that is more prejudicial than just a marked similarity and more prejudicial than just any sex crime. And so if that is what Your Honor and Judge Allen were sort of discussing there, I would agree with that, that it is sort of a spectrum and that the more similar, the more prejudicial it could be. I don't know if that's necessarily written in Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, but I agree that if it is a copy and paste, and it, essentially in this case, it would have been with regard to EH, a copy and paste. And I do think that would be more prejudicial for appellant to have a copy and paste of a Spriegel than a markedly similar Spriegel. And then I will note and emphasize that there was a cautionary instruction in this case. So to sort of summarize my points there a little bit more succinctly, I disagree that the Spriegel as it came in was not markedly similar enough in time, place, and MO. But even if this court were to say, you know, it wasn't similar enough, there simply wouldn't be the prejudice, as we've discussed so far, due to the spectrum of Spriegel evidence and how it presents itself. Judge Wheelock, I see you're unmuted. Did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to sort of touch on the whether it's prejudicial, assuming if we agree that it's error, that there wasn't a substitute counsel I want to talk about the information about the interviews, the cornerstone interviews. Why isn't it prejudicial to him to not have had his attorney have that information ahead of time so that he could be fully informed and address that more effectively during the trial? As Ms. Martin had pointed out.
I have a few responses to that, but my first would be more time does not necessarily equal more preparation. And I haven't heard an argument this morning or in the brief what additional investigation would have occurred even had the trial counsel obtained that discovery sooner. This certainly wasn't, you know, Mr. Leary's only case, and likewise, this case has passed through several prosecutors. But in terms of what additional investigation would have taken place, I still don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what other investigation could have taken place if had the corner house interview been reviewed, assuming Mr. Leary would have reviewed it at the time, what additional investigation would have been pursued. In terms of engaging in pretrial litigation, there was substantial pretrial litigation in this case, despite the corner house video not being viewed by opposing counsel until just days prior, essentially, to the testimony of EH and DH in this case. I don't think it would have any bearing on whether or not Mr. Leary would have advised his client about the plea. And I know that is true because appellant did both Mr. Leary and appellant reviewed the corner house video with time to spare to address the plea. Appellant could have gotten 280 months in this case, and instead he rejected that after having reviewed the corner house evidence, after Mr. Leary having reviewed the corner house evidence, he still rejected that plea. Could his cross-examination have been stronger? I'm not really sure how so. It still was strong. Essentially, Mr. Leary did get EH to say inconsistently what types of penetration occurred, but the jury still chose to believe EH in this case. I see I'm out of time. I have one other additional point on prejudice. Judge Wheelock, if you'd like me to continue, otherwise I can close.
You can answer briefly.
Okay. The other prejudice sort of factor that appellant is asking this court to consider is whether or not the state's case was strong, and is this court's already aware. The testimony of one credible witness is enough to satisfy a CSC conviction in this case. The setting to review materials, I do have information that's outside the record that has to do with exactly who was in the room, why, what, how'd it look like, who had headphones in, and whatnot. So some of that is outside the record, but the state has nothing to add to the record regarding that. It's just respondent believes that was plenty of review time and prep time to handle the corner house evidence in this case under the circumstances. So appellant received a fair trial and respondent is requesting this court affirm.
Thank you. With that, we will turn back to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal. I see that the clock has been reset, and Ms. Martin, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. The focus has been primarily on the hearing in front of Judge Meyer, but I would note that Judge Allen also had the ability to appoint substitute counsel. Mr. Foster made a record at the hearing the day before trial started. He said, I wanted to make a record about what I think is ineffective assistance of counsel. My attorney has not had adequate time to evaluate the videos or other reports and transcripts, and his lack of preparation puts me at risk. That was a serious allegation of inadequate representation. And Judge Allen was well aware of all of the things that came before that, with Mr. Leary refusing to sign the form. So not only should Judge Meyer have conducted a searching inquiry, at least asked one question, why do you believe your attorney is ineffective? Judge Allen also had that obligation and duty the day before trial started. Mr. Foster's request was timely and it was reasonable. He made the request 3 months before trial and again before voir dire. This is not a case where the defendant had been sitting on complaints and then surprised the court on the day of trial, like in Worthy and Clark. Here, the court was well aware of the situation leading up to trial and Mr. Leary's refusal to sign the form.
Ms. Martin, I just want to respond to your statements about Judge Allen. I mean, the judge at that point, when that comment was made, did go again into opportunities for review of this information, these records, and also made the specific comment, you know, I'll basically work with you. We'll slow down the pace of trial so that there's adequate time for that. Am I correct in that recollection?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And Judge Allen showed great patience with Brian Leary and his obstinate refusal to sign this form, but it wasn't sufficient. And Judge Allen didn't know that she had the ability to assign substitute counsel, or knowing that, despite the fact that there were exceptional circumstances in this case, failed to exercise that discretion.
So, I mean, your position is clearly that what steps she was taking at that point and comments that she was making were inadequate to address the circumstance.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Foster was entitled to an attorney who was not on his own crusade against a statute. He was entitled to an attorney who would comply with the law and get the discovery well in advance of trial. We have discovery rules in place for a reason, and that is to allow for preparation before trial. In this case, Mr. Leary made a decision that he was going to challenge this statute to the detriment of his client.
I don't want to dominate this rebuttal. Will my colleagues permit me to ask one more question? I don't mean to preclude you. I'm struggling to see how this case was not competently tried. I mean, he achieved an acquittal for one of the claims that one of the victims had made. You've made comments about, you know, inability to do a better cross-examination of experts, but I just don't see the specifics here. It seemed like, and I felt that the district court judge felt like, Mr. Leary ultimately did a very competent job at trial. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, the question is not whether he did a competent job at trial and whether, like, by reviewing the transcripts, we can say, you know, he cross-examined witnesses. The question is, did he do as good of a job as he would have done if he had had the materials in advance of trial? There's not really any way to know that other than Mr. Leary's own statements. He made lengthy records throughout the trial. They're cited in the brief. About how he would have done things differently, how he would have prepared differently. And the fact that he was able, without the discovery, to get an acquittal on one of the counts suggests that perhaps he could have done even better if he had had it. So it's not just me coming up with ideas about how things could have gone different. Mr. Leary makes a record throughout trial of the things that he would have done differently.
Ms. Martin, what authority are you relying on to say that the standard isn't whether or not the representation was competent, and rather that it was whether it was as good as it could have possibly been if he'd had any number of additional advantages, more time?
Yeah. There's a number of cases dealing with ineffective assistance of counsel, for example, that say, you know, even if the attorneys do a number of things right, if they do one thing that is correct, isn't right, that can still be ineffective assistance of counsel. Beecroft, for example, Justice Barry Anderson made that statement. And there's a number of other cases that deal with ineffective assistance of counsel, where the attorneys zealously advocated for their clients, but missed an evidentiary issue or made a mistake, and that was sufficient to find ineffective assistance of counsel.
Did it go to whether or not representation was competent, or was there the alternate standard that I think you've suggested today?
That the counsel was ineffective in those cases.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you wish to make one brief statement in closing, since the time is up?
Thank you, Your Honor. The court erred by not appointing substitute counsel in this case, and Mr. Foster asks this court to reverse and remand for proceedings where Mr. Foster can be represented by a different attorney. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for the argument here today, as well as your briefing. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. And your argument here has been very helpful to the court, so thank you for that. That ends this morning's calendar, and the court is in recess.